Welcome to episode 70 of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast for the week of May 14th, 2007. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. In this week's episode of the Fredcast, the Language Butcher returns. But first, the Floyd Landis case begins today. Tons of doping news, plus Pro Tour news, an amazing helmet story, road rage caught on tape, and a thief on a bicycle targets Houston restaurants. Following that, pronunciation lessons, a movie review, a follow-up on the iBike, some corrections, listener voicemail, and an upcoming ride. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding your bike, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. The Fredcast is brought to you by Cambria Bicycle Outfitter, providing quality products to bicycle consumers for over 20 years. Go to www.thefredcast.com to check out the Fredcast's Picks of the Week and also to find out how you can receive free shipping on your next order. Cambria Bicycle Outfitter, they outfit the world. Welcome to another episode of the Fredcast. It's great to be back. It's great to be with you. And for those of you on the web, I'm doing sort of an experiment tonight. I'm recording the show live. So now we've done that before. We've done a call-in show where you can call in and you can talk to me and talk to my guest. But tonight, actually, you can watch me as I record the show. It's a little bit bizarre. We'll see how it goes. And if this is something that it turns out that you really like, we'll do this again sometime as well. So if you happen to be watching, good evening. Welcome. Thanks for showing up to view the Fredcast being recorded. And you can see it's extremely boring as I do this. Well, let's get right down into the news. There is a lot of news, as there has been recently. And of course, unfortunately, a lot of that news has to do with doping. And topping the news this week, of course, today is May 14th, the day that I'm recording Fredcast number 70, and May 14th is a date that a lot of cycling fans have been thinking about for a long time. And the reason for that is because today is the day that the Floyd Landis case finally begins. This is the day that Floyd Landis has gone in front of the United States Anti-Doping Agency in Malibu, California, at Pepperdine University, to plead his case that he did not dope during the 2006 Tour de France and that he deserves to keep his yellow jersey and the title of Tour de France champion. And Floyd showed up today in court, not in a yellow jersey, but in a yellow tie. And I guarantee that wasn't an accident. He showed up in that tie for a reason. Just as Floyd went in, he was quoted as saying, quote, "I'm excited to get the case underway. I hope the arbitrators rule fairly and on the facts. I'm confident that if they do, I'll retain my title and be racing again." His mother was there, his father was there, and his wife was there as he sat down to get ready for the case. And today, as you can imagine, it was a contentious day. There was a lot of very technical evidence that was being introduced today into the trial. I can't really call it a trial, although I suppose that's what it is. A lot of technical evidence and a lot of back and forth between the lawyers, and of course, it was very contentious. One of the things that I learned today when we started recording the spokesman is that you can, if you'd like, get a live video cast from the proceedings at Pepperdine University for a couple $100 if you want. However, there's two websites, floydlandis.com and the Trust But Verify website, as well as the Floyd Fairness Fund website. And of course, I'll put links in the show notes to all of these websites. They're providing usernames and passwords so that just as has gone on over the last couple of months, where Floyd and his lawyers and his friends have gone out there and made his entire case public, the Floyd Landis team has decided that they would like to make the proceedings public as well. So that if you're not able to be in Malibu and if you're not able to be a member of the media and show up there to view it, you'll be able to view it online. So go ahead and check out the show notes at www.thefredcast.com. And while you're there, you'll be able to watch, while you're at work perhaps, the proceedings live from Pepperdine University. Now, there was one really strange thing as if this case isn't strange enough already, that came out last week, late last week and over the weekend, and that was that the Floyd Landis team let it be known that at one time Floyd was offered a deal if he gave up information, incriminating evidence against Lance Armstrong. Now, I think that this is really bizarre, and again, it's something that we talked about in the spokesman, and if this is true, because we don't know if it is, but if it's true, I believe that it calls the entire process just into further question. Now, there's been a lot of questions about the lab that's involved in the Floyd Landis case. There have been a lot of questions about the way in which the evidence was handled, the way in which it was announced that somebody tested positive, and then that it was announced that it was Floyd Landis, the winner of the Tour de France, who tested positive. But to now hear that Floyd might have been offered a deal to give information on Lance, somebody who isn't even racing anymore, if that's true, it just calls this entire case into further question. According to Floyd Landis, when he was offered this deal purportedly, he said, quote, "I don't think that offer justified a response. I didn't do what I'm accused of doing, and none of this has anything to do with Lance." And I think that's entirely true. Now, meanwhile, USADA's general counsel, Travis Tigert, and this is the man who supposedly made Floyd the offer, told Reuters News Service that there's certain legal rules are surrounding the entire USADA process that would not allow him to discuss matters related to the case. Nevertheless, he got a jab in anyway when he said, quote, "If Mr. Landis wishes to waive the rules and allow USADA to comment, I will be more than happy to address his nonsense. Otherwise, I can't comment." You know, finally, this thing is going to be adjudicated. Finally, we're going to get a result. I've put a very informal poll up at www.thefredcast.com. It's a one question with an either or answer. How do you think the Floyd Landis hearing will result? Will it result in a conviction, or will it result in an acquittal? Check it out at www.thefredcast.com, and you'll find it on the right-hand side of the page, just a little bit. If you just scroll a little bit down, you'll see it right there. So go ahead and vote. I'm interested to hear what you think. Try to vote this week, because the Floyd Landis hearing ends next Wednesday. Now, personally, I'm getting pretty disgusted with professional cyclists when it comes to doping, and this isn't anything against Floyd, because from what I can tell, the jury's out, and I'm hoping against hope that Floyd didn't do it, and I'm hoping that he gets acquitted. But when you look at what's going on in the rest of professional cycling, it is getting crazy. Case in point, the last time we met here on the Fredcast, we talked about the fact that Basso, Ivan Basso, the winner of last year's Giro d'Italia, had been sidelined by Discovery, and then he quit, resigned from the team. And we talked about the fact that it was a big deal when Discovery hired Basso last year, because it was at a time when he was still under investigation for doping, and then he up and quit. Why did he quit, it turns out? Well, because he admitted that he had involvement in the Operation Puerto affair. Now, he didn't say that he actually doped. As a matter of fact, he said that all he did was attempt to dope. But that, apparently, according to UCI rules and WADA rules, is just as bad as if he had doped in an actual race. According to Basso, quote, "I have admitted attempted doping only. I've never taken any doping substance nor undergone any illegal blood transfusions." Apparently, Basso made contact with Eufemiano Fuentes. That's a name that you should be very familiar with, because we've talked about him here on the Fredcast before. Eufemiano Fuentes is the doctor at the center of the Operation Puerto affair. Apparently, Basso gave him a blood sample with the intention of doping, possibly in last year's Tour de France, but he never actually did it. Said Basso, quote, "It was a moment of weakness on my part. I accept responsibility, and I'm ready to face my punishment." So now Basso is under heavy investigation by CONI, which is the Italian Olympic Committee, and seems to me that with his admission of attempted doping, that there is a very good chance that he will be banned for up to 2 years for his attempted doping. Said Basso, he's expecting that he will not be stripped of last year's Giro title. Now remember, Floyd Landis, if he is convicted of doping in last year's Tour de France, then he'll be stripped of the title. Basso, however, isn't being accused of doping in last year's Giro, only accused of this attempted doping to which he's now obviously already admitted. According to Basso, quote, "I've been one of the most monitored riders over the last 3 years. I've passed every test and am considered one of the models in terms of a rider who respects the rules. I've never been found guilty of actual doping, and everything I have achieved in my career, I have done honestly. For this reason, I am not afraid," specifically about losing his Giro title. So Basso now is out of professional cycling, possibly forever. And get this, now Tyler Hamilton, a name that many of us are very familiar with, especially here in the United States, and lots of us because he was convicted of doping and served his 2-year suspension, and this is his first season back in the professional peloton riding for the Tinkoff Credit Systems team. He has now been sidelined along with a teammate, German Jörg Jakschy. I know I'm mispronouncing it. More on mispronunciations later in the show. They've been sidelined by their team, and they were not allowed to start in this year's Giro d'Italia. Again, because of the possibility that they have been implicated in the Operation Puerto affair. According to the Tinkoff Credit Systems team, the decision was aimed at, quote, "relieving pressure created around the Giro. The two riders have been suspended until the authorities have sorted the implications of Operation Puerto." And if that wasn't enough depressing news about professional cyclists being suspected of doping or attempted doping, there's now a report in Italy's La Gazzetta dello Sport newspaper that looked at the documents that came out of Operation Puerto, especially the ones that were issued in March by Spanish judge Antonio Serrano. Looking at those papers, along with some papers that were issued previously, they've discovered what they say is evidence that Alejandro Valverde also had blood samples and blood bags that were in Eufemiano Fuentes' lab, and that while Basso's blood did not contain any doping agents, that Valverde's contained evidence of EPO. And we've talked about EPO before. EPO is one of the banned substances that is popular among, or at least potentially popular, among those who would or do dope. No word yet as to whether or not Valverde will also be sanctioned for his possible involvement or sidelined for his possible involvement, but it is a sad state of affairs, and it's so sad that there is, or there was, an essay on theage.com, and I've put a link in the show notes because it's something that I think that you should read in its entirety, but I'd like to read just a couple of excerpts from the article because it certainly explains how I feel, and I know how some of you feel as well. The essay's author is a gentleman by the name of Michael Coulter, and he begins by saying, "Hello, my name is Michael, and I'm a cycling fan. I've been a cycling fan for more than 10 years. I've watched my last race on Sunday. I became a cycling fan after buying a cheap mountain bike to get fit. I started buying bike magazines and became intrigued with stories about the wave of Australians making their mark in Europe. Riders such as Neil Stevens, Stephen Hodge, and Patrick Jonker. Before long, I was paying attention to the small print results in the back pages of the newspaper and cursing when I couldn't find out how the Aussies did at the Tour of Switzerland. During the Tour de France, I would go out of my way not to listen to morning sports bulletins on the radio so I could watch the nightly highlights as if it were live. The first time I thought I might have a problem was during the 1998 Tour, the one everyone remembers as being destroyed by the Festina drug scandal. I remember it as being the one Marco Pantani won after casting down Germany's Jan Ulrich in an epic duel through the Alps. Then there was the Lance Armstrong incident, when the great man passed so close to me during the time trial at the Sydney Olympics that I convinced myself that some of his sweat had splashed onto me. Delusional? Almost certainly. I used to say it didn't matter who was on drugs because the rider with the most courage, daring, and greatest capacity to suffer would still win. Now, I don't know. Spain's doping investigation, Operation Puerto, has sullied the name of most of Europe's best riders. It's hard to see where this will stop. The more the past decade of cycling is investigated, the harder it is to take any achievement on face value. It's one thing to say flippantly, as most fans have at one time or another, that, quote, most of them are probably on the juice. It's quite another to have it proven. If it's true that the first step to solving a problem is admitting you have one, cycling must take the first step now. The best and boldest thing the sport could do is offer an amnesty to the professional peloton so that dirty riders can come forward and confess without punishment or retrospective removal of titles or earnings. There would have to be a trade-off. Every rider must take a DNA test when they sign a contract, have weekly blood testing at the team's expense, and face an automatic life ban for a first doping offense. Since it's clear that doping culture starts at the top with team management, the entire outfit should be deregistered and expelled if a single rider tests positive. That also brings peer pressure, probably the most effective policing measure, into play. I'm a cycling fan, and there's no help for me, but I, for one, would love to see the sport go into rehab. When I read this article, I couldn't agree more. This is exactly what cycling needs. Tough love and tough measures, because that's what tough times require. As a cycling fan, as a cyclist, as a cycling podcaster, and sort of a pseudo-cycling media member, I'm constantly bombarded by people who tell me that I'm out of my mind for continuing to watch professional cycling or to care about professional cyclists, because after all, as the author of this article says, they're all on the juice. I hope against hope that that's not true, but I think that the only way that we can be sure that it's true is if professional cycling bites the bullet and takes some of these tough measures. I agree with every one of them. I have a feeling that many of you do also. Well, speaking of Yvonne Basso and Tyler Hamilton and the Giro d'Italia, it is time once again for the first of the three Grand Tours of the year. It's time for the Giro d'Italia. Now, the week leading up to the Giro d'Italia was pretty much a rest week for most of the professional peloton or the Pro Tour peloton, having just completed the Tour de Romandie May 1st through the 6th in Switzerland. This year's Tour of Romandie was won by Thomas Dekker from Team Rabobank. Second place went to Paolo Salvadelli from Team Astana. Third, Andrei Kazechkin from Kazakhstan and Team Astana. Fourth, Cadel Evans from Australia and Predictor Lotto. And fifth place went to Chris Horner from the United States and the Predictor Lotto team. Well, the teams were ready and got set to start the Giro d'Italia, and the Pro Tour standings leading up to the Giro d'Italia showed Italian David Rebellin in first place, second place Alejandro Valverde, who we spoke about before, third place Danilo De Luca from Italy. In team points, Team CSC is in first, Liquigas in second place, and third place Rabobank. Now it's time for the Giro d'Italia, which is ongoing right now. It started 2 days ago, May the 12th. It started with a team time trial, and this year's Stage 1 team time trial was won by Team Liquigas, and the first one to cross the line was Enrico Gasparato, and as a result, he got to wear the pink jersey in the next stage of the event. Team Astana came in second place, and Discovery came in fifth. The reason I mentioned Discovery is because, remember, we talked about the fact that Yvonne Basso is now no longer on the team. The track star Steve Cummings from Great Britain has taken Basso's place on the squad. This is his first time in a Grand Tour event, and so obviously for them to have come in fifth place, he's obviously in good shape, and of course we wish him a lot of luck as he proceeds down the rest of the three-week journey that is the Giro d'Italia. Cummings was quoted as saying, quote, "I was a bit of an unknown when I came here, but I've concentrated on racing well, being consistent, just doing whatever they asked in the races. It's gone well. I've just kept it simple, and when they asked me to do something, I've done it to the best of my ability and raced hard." So we'll see how he works over 3 weeks as he goes continuing down the road with the Giro d'Italia and the Discovery squad. Meanwhile, let's talk about Stage 2 of this year's Giro d'Italia. This was a 205-kilometer event, and it was won by Australian Robbie McEwen at the line when he out-sprinted Paolo Bettini. Bettini took second place in the second stage, and third place went to Alessandro Petacchi. In the end, however, it was Italy's Danilo De Luca who took over the pink jersey because the previous race leader, Licky Gas's Enrico Gasparato, had a crash. He did finish, but the delay cost him the pink jersey for the day. Today's third stage of the Giro d'Italia saw, once again, Alessandro Petacchi having a great race, winning this third stage of the race at the line in a sprint with Robert Forster from Germany and Ariel Richese from Argentina in a sprint finish. It was a 181-kilometer route, and they made it in 4 hours, 22 minutes, and 57 seconds, said Petacchi, quote, "It was a very long sprint over cobblestones. It was one of the best sprints of my career." At the end of the day, Enrico Gasparato had regained the overall lead and was back in pink as they head down through the rest of the roads of Italy on this 3-week journey. I'll be back next week with more information on how the ride has progressed. And for those of you who are following the Pro Tour calendar this year, the next race up on the Pro Tour calendar for 2007 is the Tour of Catalunya. This takes place May the 21st through the 27th. So it's going on concurrently with the Giro d'Italia. I will bring results of that as it happens. Now, meanwhile, back down to earth and us mere mortals who actually have to battle with cars when we're out on the roads. This is a story that I read about and that was also emailed to me by listener Mark. And I'm just going to set up the beginning of it, and then you're not going to believe how it ends. The story begins, and this is from the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. And it begins as follows. A white panel delivery truck ran over a UW Madison graduate student's head on Division Street Friday afternoon. And, except for a concussion, he wasn't hurt. The story goes on to say that Ryan Lipscomb, who's 26, said that he was riding his bicycle pretty fast. And just before 3 p.m., he had a green light, so the crosswalk for the bike path showed a walk sign. He then saw the large truck, the kind that usually makes deliveries to offices. It was coming down the street, getting ready to make a right turn. He said that he couldn't tell if the truck was going to stop, so he slammed on his brakes. Unfortunately, he flipped his bike. He got thrown into the street. He landed right at the intersection, and that's when the truck ran over his head. Said the unfortunate cyclist, quote, "I didn't see it coming, but I sure felt it roll over my head. It feels really strange to have a truck run over your head." His helmet, by the way, which was a Giro, was crushed, but his head was fine. I recommend you go to the link that's in the show notes where you can take a look at the picture of not only Ryan, but Ryan's helmet as well. We had this long conversation for weeks and weeks and weeks about whether or not mandatory helmet laws were a good thing or a bad thing. You know what? It doesn't matter. When I see a picture like this and when I hear a story like this, which, you know, is a one in a million, there's no doubt about that. I think most people, whether they were wearing a helmet or not, if they got run over by a truck, unfortunately, I think that they'd be goners. In this case, it came out amazingly well. And it's just one more reason, as far as I can tell, wear your helmets out there, because this is just an amazing story. And a great story for Bike to Work Week, which is what this is this week. So thanks to listener Mark for sending the story to me. And congratulations to Ryan Lipscomb. He definitely has a guardian angel. Oh, and of course, the folks at Giro have an amazing story that they can put in their next advertisement. Could you imagine seeing the advertisement that they're probably going to have for this? Incredible story. Hey, do you remember the story that we talked about a couple of months ago? It happened up in Portland, Oregon, where a cyclist got bumped by a bus, and there was an altercation that took place between the cyclist and a passenger on the bus, and it was all caught on the bus's video cameras. Okay, so get this. Here's the latest video camera incident showing road rage against a cyclist. This one took place up in Toronto, Canada, about a week ago, where a group of students were on a field trip, and they were investigating the positives and negatives of public surveillance cameras. You know, the ones you see on the tops of buildings and light posts. And they're, you know, in big cities, they're all around us. They ended up videoing an altercation between a motorist and a cyclist. Apparently what happened was the cyclist was riding down the road and the light that he was coming up to at an intersection turned yellow. And so the cyclist stopped. Apparently the car behind him, the driver of that car, got very upset at the fact that he had to stop at this yellow light. When they started going, the driver caught up with the cyclist, got out, and started wailing on the guy. As a matter of fact, it was so bad that the cyclist actually lost a tooth. All of this was caught on the students' video cameras. And you can see the cyclist desperately trying to protect himself by holding up his bike between himself and his assailant. Unfortunately, again, he lost his tooth. The assailant got back in his car and drove away. And the assailant's car, as well as his license plate, were caught on the students' video cameras. The students took the video, as well as some still photos that they took of the victim, took them to the police in Toronto. And when I first heard this story, I thought, this is fantastic. I hope they find this guy, and I hope that they prosecute him. Now, in my best Paul Harvey imitation, I'm about to tell you the rest of the story. So now, this whole thing was caught on tape, right? And the students turned it into the police. Little did the students know that when they turned it into the police, the individual who was the assailant, the one that they were turning in to the police, was none other than Constable Darius Tierman, a 21-year veteran, you guessed it, of the Toronto Police Force, as well as a recipient of a commendation last June for teamwork. Now, he's been on leave since October 2004, and when all of this aired, he turned himself in to the Toronto Police, and now he's under investigation and was released on a $5,000 bail. He's been charged with assault causing bodily harm, and he has an order to continue undergoing psychiatric care. So, you see, there is justice in the world. It's very strange to me that this was done by a police officer, but personally, I'm very glad that it was caught on tape. The victim, hopefully, will get some justice out of the situation, and hopefully the assailant will get a little bit of help, and hopefully other motorists who may have seen this video might have learned a lesson. And at the same time, perhaps the students, the high school students who videoed it, also learned a lesson about what the pros and cons may or may not be of public surveillance cameras. All in all, it's a great story. And the videos, if you want to watch them, are very compelling. And I've put links in the show notes where you can see both the video from the day that the first story broke, as well as the video when they interviewed the victim once he found out that his assailant was a police officer. Very, very compelling. Now, speaking of altercations between cyclists and drivers, you remember a couple of weeks ago we talked at length about an incident that occurred in the city of San Francisco during a critical mass event where there was a confrontation between the driver of a minivan and some of the cyclists who were participating in the event. There has been yet another incident involving bikes and coincidentally, a minivan, this time across the bay in Berkeley, California, where participants in the critical mass have accused a motorist of trying to run them over. Now, this time, the clash was caught on video. And unfortunately, the video that's available on the web is edited. And according to the police, they say that the unedited video shows a very different story. And the last I heard, they were not planning on charging the driver who was involved in the incident. The video that I've seen shows the minivan very clearly in the middle of the street and one, possibly two, or even more bicycles underneath the right front tire of the minivan. According to those who were there, the driver deliberately ran into the group of cyclists who were passing through the intersection. Another report that I read said that the leaders of, well, not the leaders, but those who were in the front of the critical mass had a green light when they went through the intersection. But since there were 100 or more cyclists involved, it's quite possible that those who were at the back of the critical mass may not have had a green light. Apparently, the motorist was an elderly gentleman. One account says that he brandished a knife against the cyclist. Another account says that he found a farming or a gardening tool in his car that he brandished just because he was being threatened. I have seen pictures of the minivan. It has a broken front. windshield, sort of reminiscent of what happened to the minivan that was in San Francisco. I'm sure there's much more that we can learn about this incident. But you know what, folks? If you're out there and you're participating in these critical mass rides, listen, it's quite obvious that there will be confusion among the drivers, and drivers who are already confused having cyclists on the road to begin with. There's going to be confusion. There's going to be some anger. And I understand that critical mass is all about, for some, taking back the streets, about demonstrating a greener form of transportation, something that's better for the environment, better for individuals. But you know, at the same time, you have to always remember something that I was taught by my dad when he taught me to drive, which is, you know what? There are a lot of people on the road who don't understand who you are and what you're planning on doing. If you keep that in mind and you drive, in this case, ride defensively, I really don't think that things like this are going to happen. So I think just being a little bit smarter when you're out there, and whether you agree with critical mass or you don't agree with critical mass, I think you can agree with the sentiment of, you know what, if you look out for yourself and you know that people out there are just not understanding of cyclists, I think that we'll all be in a better spot. If that light had turned red and those cyclists didn't stop, I'm not saying that the driver was justified, but I think that it's an accident waiting to happen. There may be more to hear about this story, and if so, I will be sure to bring it to you here on the Fredcast. Hey, I'm wondering, have any of you seen the new cycling movie, The Flying Scotsman, about Scottish cyclist Graham Obrey? If you haven't, that's okay. I'm going to be talking about it a little bit later on in the show. But if you have, you'll know that it's about a cyclist. Part of it is about a cyclist on a track trying to break a famous world record. We have a little bit of that going on right now down in La Paz, Bolivia. That's where British cyclist Chris Hoy has made several attempts at the record in the kilometer. In other words, trying to see how fast he can ride a kilometer from a standing start. He has so far made two attempts. The first, he was short of the world record by 0.128 seconds. I mean, that's not even the blink of an eye. In the second, he was off by 0.005 seconds. That was his second attempt on Sunday. Both of these are taking place at the Alto Irpavi Velodrome, which is the world's highest cycling track in Bolivia. Disappointed that he didn't get the kilo record, but nevertheless, he has gotten the half-kilometer record. The previous record for the half-kilometer was 25.850 seconds, set in 2001 by Frenchman Arnaud Doublet. This time, Hoy beat the record by doing it in 24.758 seconds. At the end of the race, or at the end of the ride, he said, quote, "It was an amazing feeling. I just felt as though I was flying down the back straight. After the disappointment of the kilometer, I wanted to go home with something, and I'm happy for all the team that I've set this record." So congratulations to Chris Hoy. I believe that there is still a possibility that he may go one more time for the kilo record, but still, the half a kilometer, the 500 meters, is an amazing feat. Congratulations to him for setting the new world record in the 500 meters. And finally tonight, I just have to urge all of you, please, use your bicycles for good, not for evil, as this individual is doing in Houston, Texas. Five restaurants in southwest Houston were burglarized last week by a thief who police are still searching for. The crime spree began around 1:45 in the morning and lasted only a few minutes. And it also returned little reward because the burglar made off with a grand total of $0 in cash. And he made his getaway on, you guessed it, a bicycle. According to the story that I read, quote, "which we hear is the preferred means of transportation for environmentally friendly burglars these days." Great thing was, speaking of surveillance cameras, the thief was caught on a surveillance camera at the Buffalo Grill. And the owner of the Buffalo Grill said, quote, "he just came in and went for the cash register, took the register and threw it and took it outside and opened it." And he repeated this at four more restaurants. According to one of the restaurant owners, Jackie Patan, they speculate that the man was, quote, "probably juiced up on something other than life, so he'll get caught." Hopefully he will, and hopefully he'll turn in his bike and no longer use it for evil as I hope you all will only use your bikes for good. And with that, we'll end the news for tonight, May 14th, 2007. Well, hopefully among you, the Fredcast listeners, I'm known for my excellent vocal sound and for my knowledge of cycling and for the enthusiasm that I bring to the Fredcast and the spokesman every time I do one of these shows. But I think one of the other things that I may be known for is my butchering of foreign language and foreign names. Well, one of your compatriots, listener William, sent me some language lessons that I could use whenever I didn't know how to pronounce certain words and certain names. So here, from listener William or Bill, are the correct ways to pronounce certain words. I will give you my pronunciation, and then you will hear his. And hopefully, I'll be able to use these in the future when I mention some of these people and places and things. So the first is the race that we talked about on a very recent Fredcast, and that is what I called La Flèche Wallonne. Here, of course, is the correct way to pronounce that famous race.
La Flèche Wallonne.
Okay, I think I did pretty well with that one. You know, I mean, I don't have quite the intonation, but I was close. Okay, so now the next one is, and this one I really messed up, I think I called it the Mur de Huy. Here's the correct way to pronounce that location on a very famous race.
Mur de Huy.
Okay, not quite as good. Let me try that. Mur de Huy. How'd I do? Not bad, right? Okay, we'll see. Let's see how we do on the next one. The next one, I keep saying Danilo De Luca. Here's the correct way to say that famous cyclist's name.
Danilo.
Okay, so it's not Danilo, it's Danilo. And I think when I mentioned him tonight, did I say it a little bit better? Hopefully I did. Okay, next up I have no idea how to say this one. I read it in the email because it was written there, and I'm going to give it a try, and then you can hear the correct way to say it. I would have said Jela Nidam. So now let's see how I did. Did I get it correct?
Jela Nidam.
The butcher strikes again. Next up. All right, this one, I keep saying it, Oscar Freire. Did I get this one correct? Let's find out.
Oscar Freire.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm being mocked. Child's play. Oscar Freire. Like Frere Jacques, of course, right? Like the song. All right, next. I have no idea. I'm not even going to try either one of these. You try to see if you could pronounce these. I'll put the words in the show notes and then pause here. Go to the show notes, try to say these two names, and then come back to the podcast and see if you got these two correct.
Jamuladin Abdujaparov.
Come on, did you get that one? All right, how about this one?
Unai Echevarria.
So, of course, in my reply, I asked Bill whether or not he could pronounce the name of the gentleman who's the actor who plays Mr. Echo on ABC TV's Lost. And I didn't get anything back by way of a WAV file or any sort of a recorded file. So here is the name of the gentleman who plays Mr. Echo on Lost. His name is Adewale Akinoye Agbaje. So there, Bill, two can play at this game. And I will try, as I always do, to get the pronunciations right from now on.
Small town in Scotland.
Help!
Being picked on was a daily struggle for young Graham Obrey until
Merry Christmas, son.
He discovered he was born with a gift that would help him escape
Graham!
Into a whole new world. Now, his fascination will become an obsession that will change everything. Question authority.
Saddles must be 5 centimeters behind the center line of the bottom bracket.
Five centimeters.
And
defy convention. What you're listening to is the trailer or the preview for the new movie coming to a city near you, I hope, called The Flying Scotsman. The Flying Scotsman tells the story of Scottish cyclist Graham Obrey. Graham Obrey won several world records in his career, and he had quite a quirky career indeed, because Graham Obrey started from very humble means and got into the world of professional cycling from a very strange angle. As a matter of fact, the bike that he broke a world record on was literally built from washing machine parts. And there's a great scene in the movie, and Tim Jackson talked about it today when we were talking on The Spokesman, where the actor playing Graham Obrey is sort of staring off at his wife's washing machine as it goes into the spin cycle or the extract cycle. And he's looking at it. In the next scene, he's seen taking the washing machine apart as he's trying to get at those bearings that are able to spin so quickly as it's spinning the water out of the clothes, and that's what he makes his bottom bracket out of, so that he can spin his own legs quickly, so that he can beat the hour record going up against famous cyclist Chris Boardman. I enjoyed this movie immensely, and it's funny because I'm not quite sure if I enjoyed it more because it was a really great movie or whether it was because it was a really great cycling movie. You know, I'm not somebody who goes out to a lot of movies, although last week I did see two. Quite the juxtaposition here. Spider-Man 3 with the kids and The Flying Scotsman by myself. This was a really great movie, not just because of the cycling, to be serious, but because Graham Obrey is quite an interesting human interest story as well. He got into cycling because he was teased, taunted, and really beat up and humiliated by the bullies in his Scottish town where he grew up when he was a kid. And his father one day brought home for Graham a bicycle. And Graham was able to use the bicycle as his means of escaping from these bullies. And he found a talent within himself, the talent to be perhaps one of Scotland's finest and fastest bicycle racers. At the same time, Graham Obrey was also fighting, and perhaps to this day still fights, depression. And so you have a very interesting human interest story about Graham and his family and his friends and Graham's depression, as well as Graham's obsession to break cycling records and to become perhaps Scotland's most famous and most talented cyclist. It was a really enjoyable movie. I highly recommend it to you. The problem with it is, at least here in the United States, it's only playing in a few select cities: Chicago, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Boston, Washington, D.C., Seattle, Houston, New York, Baltimore, and in Canada, it's playing in Toronto. I was lucky enough, I happened to be on a business trip last week in Seattle. I noticed that it was playing not far from my hotel. Had dinner, went down to the movie theater, expected that it was going to be busy, and was really disappointed to find that there was only one other person in this large movie theater. It was me and my junior mints and him and whatever he was eating across the movie theater, and just the two of us. And that's very disappointing because it doesn't bode well for the possibility of The Flying Scotsman being in wider release here in the United States and in Canada. So for those of you that are in those cities, I highly recommend that you go out, catch the movie as soon as you can before it leaves. And hopefully, if it gets a big enough box office, and I'm not thinking it's going to get a Spider-Man 3 kind of box office, but if it gets a big enough box office, hopefully it will be able to open in other cities, because it's a movie worth seeing. And if it doesn't, it should be on DVD soon, and you'll be able to get a chance to view the movie. If you'd like to see the trailer, not just hear the little bit that I played for you, I've put a link in the show notes to the official website for the movie, and I've also put a link to Graham Obrey's book about his experiences on which the movie is based. The movie is rated PG-13, but I think it's certainly one that you could take your older kids to. I would certainly take my 10-year-old to it, and I think any kids older than that you could take as well. a very enjoyable movie, and I believe not just for cyclists, but you could also bring your cycling spouse, significant other, and your kids, and I think you'll really enjoy it. It's called The Flying Scotsman, hopefully coming to a theater near you very soon. Now, the last time we met here on the Fredcast, I offered you the first of what will be several reviews of various power meters that are available out there on the market. And the first power meter that I reviewed is the iBike. And you'll recall that the iBike utilizes an algorithm to determine your power output in conjunction with the slope and the wind and the speed and your cadence. And it doesn't actually have a sensor that directly measures the power output from your legs, be that in the hub of your rear wheel or in the crank or the bottom bracket, as some of the other power meters on the market. But then again, the iBike is also one of the least expensive power meters on the market. A couple of comments that I made about the iBike, to which I received responses from iBike's president. Number one, I mentioned the fact that I would love to see the sensors be fully wireless. It would make for a much easier and quicker installation. And the response I got back was that a fully wireless system is indeed in the works. Wireless speed, cadence, and heart rate. So that's something that we can be looking forward to very soon. And one of the really cool things about that, something that I really love, is that the wireless sensors will be in the new mount that will go along with the heart rate sensor, so that your existing iBike computer, if you have one or if you go out and you purchase one, will be compatible with these wireless sensors. When they come out, you'll just have to change your mount. So that's a really great thing to know about. Next, and this was something that I was taken to task on by many of you, perhaps again because I live in a warmer part of the world here in Southern California, and I'm only on my trainer a couple times in the winter, where a lot of you who live in snowy or colder climates, you're on your trainer throughout the winter, every day, every night, whenever you do your training. And so you felt that perhaps I maybe glossed over the fact that you can't use the iBike on a trainer. And I didn't mean to, because I do think that that's significant. However, you'll be happy to know that a trainer mount is coming out soon from iBike later this year. And again, an existing iBike will remain unchanged and will be compatible with that trainer mount. So that's great news, especially for those of you who've been sending me emails for the last couple of weeks about that. And then finally, they're hoping that Intel Macintosh drivers will be available soon. And from what I understand, this is the one portion of the iBike that they purchase from a third party. And that third party has been a bit slow in developing those Intel compatible Macintosh drivers. Again, until then, you can indeed use it with Bootcamp or with Parallels or however it is that you access Windows on your Mac. Now, I did get several other comments from some of you, and one of the typical things that a lot of you mentioned was the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, the iBike calculates the amount of power that you're exerting when you ride, as compared to some of the other ones out there that use direct sensors. And I'm also testing my next unit right now, which is the new CatEye CS600, which also estimates the power by sensing the chain on your bike. And a lot of you commented that you didn't like the fact that, to use your words, it was estimating the amount of power, and that therefore these types of units introduce more error or a larger percentage of error into the power readings that they give you. Here's the bottom line on this. I'd like you to stay tuned for each of the power meter reviews that I'm going to do, because right now all I'm doing is I'm doing reviews of each power meter in a vacuum. I'm not ready to compare one power meter to another until I get to the end of the roundup. I've got two waiting in the wings right now to test, and I've got hopefully at least two more coming. And when I'm done with the entire series, I'll then give you a comparison of the various power meters. And hopefully, I mean, you should see my handlebars right now. I already have three or four things on my handlebars as I'm testing each of these. I was on a long ride last weekend and I was riding next to a guy and he just gave me quite the double take because you can believe how my handlebars looked like the cockpit of a fighter jet. But I'm doing it for a reason, because now I can compare head-to-head various power meters and use them on the same rides, bring them up on the computer, and compare the results. So for right now, bear with me and understand that I'm going to come back to a lot of the issues that you're bringing up right now. So don't send me emails telling me you're disappointed in the reviews that I'm doing, because right now, again, just comparing them individually, I'll do the head-to-head test later on and let you know my comments on each. Do love your comments. Please do continue sending them. Please do put them up on the website, because they generate some great conversation. There's one up there right now that talks about the fact that the way that you calibrate the iBike is by doing what I described last week, which is a coast down, in which it calculates your drag coefficient. And one of the commenters mentioned that if you calibrate it with your hands, for instance, on the brake hoods, and then later go harder on a ride with your hands in the drops, these coefficients could change, and then the iBike might calculate your power output lower or higher, depending on the way that that works. Now, I'll certainly get a comment on that from John, who's the president of iBike, but just be patient until I'm all done so that I can then compare each unit to each of the other units. But please do keep those comments coming. I love to get them from you. Speaking of getting comments from listeners, here's another little piece that I've got to do, just a little correction based on some listener email that I recently received. So after last week's show, I got a couple of emails, and I think that this one probably represents all the dozens that I got from those of you out there. This comes from Randy and Saba Steed from Churchill, Tennessee. They say, David, just finished listening to show number 69 and truly enjoyed the show and greatly appreciate the effort that you put into your podcast. Thank you very much. I do have a question regarding the Tour of Georgia coverage. Has Arnold pulled a quick one on us? Now, let me explain. Arnold is the Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is the governor of the state of California, also known as the Governator or the Terminator. And what exactly they're talking about here with Arnold pulling a quick one, well, let me see if I can explain this in my own words from last week's show. Here's what I said last week, introducing my coverage of the Tour of Georgia. The Tour of Georgia took place April 16th through the 22nd in the southeastern state of Georgia here in the United States of California, and it was yet another return.
Did you
the
catch
pro
that?
Peloton,
yeah, that was sort of a little States bit of a mistake that I made there. So Randy and Saba go on to say, you stated that Georgia is in the southeastern part of the United States of California. I must have been riding a century during the takeover. Oh, well, California is one of the most beautiful places I've ever visited. I'm glad to now be part of it. Looking forward to hearing about Emily's ride across California. My wife and I enjoy our weekly Fredcast fix. Many thanks, etc. So, Randy, thanks so much for sending that email. And oops, I guess I sort of messed up. And to all the rest of you that sent the emails, there's too many of you to mention. I apologize. Yes, Georgia is in the southeastern part of the United States of America. California, of course, is in the extreme southwestern portion of the United States of America. My apologies to those of you in Georgia. It was just a slip of the tongue. What can I say? Now, the next piece of listener mail that I got was a voicemail that I received from listener Rick, and he wanted to point something out about just a safety tip, and you know how I feel about safety. This one is something that may make you feel a little bit dorky, if you will, but I think that this is something that can certainly help save lives. So here's listener Rick with his safety tip for this week.
Hi, David. This is Rick Bruce, a Fred from Pennsylvania. I'm calling you on a couple of things. First of all, in response to National Bike Month, Team J&J, of which I am a captain of a sub-team that's going out in a few weeks, for the MS ride down the coast of New Jersey, known as the Coast to Coast Ride. It's sponsored by the Mid-Jersey chapter of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. That 190-mile ride is due to go off on the 19th and conclude on the 20th of May, right in the middle of bike week or bike month. Of course, I'm preparing for that. Tonight, I was out for my first actual night, fully night ride with a bunch of things. And I wanted to make some notes about safety, because I know that's been going back and forth a lot. And I have noticed that I wore a something more I haven't worn in the past. I wore a reflective construction vest over top of my typical bright yellow rain jacket, you know, cycling rain jacket. I also have bar-end flashers on my drop handlebars, as well as a flashing rear light coming below my seat on the seat stem, and also a flashing white light off the front of the bike. And I, with all those combinations of all that gear, going out tonight for about a three-hour ride in the darkness, I didn't have one person honk me. I didn't have anybody try to pass me so close that I could reach their side view mirror or anything. People gave me were very friendly, very helpful, avoiding me and everything else. And this is Philadelphia, the so-called city of brotherly love, but not necessarily. So I wanted to encourage people that ride either at night or even during the daytime. Make yourself as gaudy as possible, and if you do it in a responsible way, people actually appreciate that and do it. So hope everybody's having a safe bike month.
Hey, Rick, thank you so much for the voicemail, and everybody, sorry for the noise. Sometimes those voicemails come across with just a ton of noise, and when I try to reduce the noise in post-production, I end up also sometimes reducing the voice quality. So in this case, this was the best that we had. So, Rick, thank you very much for that. Congratulations on doing an MS ride, and thank you for everyone whose lives are affected by MS. We appreciate you doing that. Good luck this weekend on the ride. I've heard of that one, and it's supposed to be a lot of fun, so enjoy. As far as the tip that Rick had, which is to wear one of those orange or yellow reflective traffic vests, as I said earlier, it can really make you feel sort of silly to wear that when you're riding. And I know when Emily and I did the ride across California, every single rider, whether it was a parent or a kid, had to wear one of those vests. And I remember when I first saw photos of the tour of the ride across California. See, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to say, you know, the United States of Georgia or something. Anyway, when I first saw pictures of the ride across California, I thought there's no way I'm going to wear one of those vests. But I have to tell you, for that whole week, Rick's absolutely right. People gave us much wider berth. Now, I don't know if that was because we were with little kids or whether that was because we were wearing the traffic vests or a combination thereof. Nevertheless, I did really feel that there was a larger separation between myself and the cars during that week. Now, I haven't taken to wearing one of those vests on my regular ride since, but I can vouch for what Rick is saying. So if you live in some place like Philadelphia, like LA, like any of these other places where there's a lot of traffic and not a whole lot of room for bikes, and this is something that concerns you and something that you have a problem with, here's another great solution. So Rick, thanks for sending that along. It's a great safety tip for National Bike Month. Appreciate it very much. Now, speaking of National Bike Month, there's another event that takes place every year during National Bike Month. And I know I talked about it last year, and it bears repeating this year. This is taking place May 16th. That's Wednesday night this week at 7 p.m. at hundreds of locations worldwide. And this is called the Ride of Silence. From the website, it says, join cyclists worldwide in a silent, slow-paced ride, maximum of 12 miles per hour, in honor of those who have been injured or killed while cycling on public roadways. And it exists to honor those who have been injured or killed, to raise awareness that cyclists are out there on the road, and to ask that we all share the road. I've put a link in the show notes to the rideofsilence.org website, where you can go find a location near you so that Wednesday night you can participate in a ride of silence, or if there's not one near you, to add a location so that you can have a ride of silence in your community. It's a great idea. Since listener Ray brought it to my attention and reminded me of it again this year, I've put a link also in the show notes to the ride in which Ray will be participating in the Miami, Florida area. It's a great idea. I'm going to go out Wednesday night and participate in my local Ride of Silence, and I hope that you will too, because as we talk about all too often on the show, talked about it tonight, think about the rider who was whose head was run over by a truck. It can be very dangerous out there, and raising a little bit of awareness in a very positive and peaceful way can really go a long way, and something that I think that we should all get behind. So if you've got the time Wednesday night at 7 p.m., check out rideofsilence.org and get involved. I think you'll be really glad that you did. Well, I think that's going to do it for the show tonight. We're already an hour in, and unfortunately, my interview of Emily from the Ride Across California is just a little bit long, and so I'm not going to have time to put it into this week's show. I think I'll do a supplemental show this week so that before next week, you will get to hear finally about our experiences on the Ride Across California, and I've gotten a lot of emails from a lot of you, and I know you want to hear about it. So I will get it up this week, I promise. In the meantime, just a couple of quick notes. Don't forget that Fredcast socks are still available, although I noticed that our inventory is starting to dwindle. So if you haven't ordered yours yet, listen, spring, summer's here. It's time to get out there and ride. So get your Fredcast socks on. You can get those at the website at www.thefredcast.com. Thanks again to Cambria Bicycle Outfitter for sponsoring the show. Can't tell you how much I appreciate their sponsorship and how much I appreciate your patronage of Cambria Bicycle Outfitter. Your supporting them helps them support me. So go to the website at www.thefredcast.com and make sure that when you shop at CBO that you do so through the Fredcast so that they know how you got there, and that that will help me make sure that they want to continue sponsoring the show. So I appreciate that very much. Of course, if you'd like to send me an email with any questions or comments, and that can be text or voice, please do so. The email address is thefredcast@gmail.com. And of course, you can also follow the Fredcast on Twitter. That's twitter.com/Fredcast. And you can send audio comments to the listener hotline at area code 206-203-FRED. And visit the website anytime for show notes and links and additional comments between shows at www.thefredcast.com. Now it's time for our PodSafe Cycling music. Our PodSafe Cycling music comes to us, as always, from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. Tonight's music is Let Well Enough Be by Ray Shinnery, an amazing blues artist that I first heard about on Adam Christensen's The Mattcast at mattcast.com. So Adam, thanks for turning me on to Ray. I think his music is awesome, and hopefully the rest of you will think so too. I've put links in the show notes to Ray's website as well as to Ray's site on the Pod Show Network. So until next week, thanks for listening. Thanks for staying subscribed. I hope that you enjoy this music as much as I do. And most of all, enjoy the ride. She made